cold and heat and yet let in light. People at home sometimes did that using the tissue of animals' stomachs. But those who had built the great village had access to some kind of rock or hard substance that came in sheets. They must have been very clever people. He saw a great yawning doorway ahead of him. The doors had fallen away and lay there half buried in the sand. The inside of the building gaped darkly. Johnny walked his horse through the door and looked about in the dimness. Debris was scattered all about, rotted and decayed beyond identification. But a waist-high series of platforms stood. They were of a remarkably white stone that had bluish veins in it. He leaned down from his horse and stared at the walls behind them. There were heavy, heavy doors set into it, two of them ajar, one of them wide open. Big wheels of still bright metal were inset into them. Johnny stepped to the platforms of white stone and dropped to the other side. Cautiously, he approached the open niche. There were shelves, and on the shelves, tangled with rotted remains of some kind of sacking, were mounds and mounds and mounds of discs. Some were a dull gray, almost tarnished away, but one pile was bright yellow. Johnny picked up a disc. It was as wide across as two fingernails and remarkably heavy. He turned it over and his eyes bugged. There was that bird again, talons gripping a bundle of arrows. Hastily, he pawed into the other mounds, looking at disc after disc. Most of them had a bird on one side. The face of a man, the faces of different men, were on the other. Face of a man. And some of them had women on them. This was not a god symbol. This was a man symbol. The bird with the arrows belonged to man. The shock of it sent him reeling. He supported himself against the wall of the niche for minutes. He felt his head buzzing with the readjustment of ideas. These doors to the niches were man-made. The great village was man-made. The doors of the tomb in the mountains were of similar material, even if larger. The tomb was not a god tomb. The mound out on the plain was also man-made. Man had once built things. He was certain of it. And it would take many men to make this great village. Therefore, there must have been many men at one time. He rode his horse out of the place in a deep daze. His most basic ideas and values had suffered severe shifts, and it took a lot of getting used to. What legends were true? Which ones were false? There was the legend of the great village, and here it was. Man had obviously made it, and had lived here in forgotten times. Maybe the legend of God getting angry with man and wiping him out was true. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it had just been a big storm. He looked around the paths and buildings. There was no evidence of a storm. The buildings were still standing. Many even had a strange, thin sheeting in the windows. There were no bodies about, but from a time so long ago, bones wouldn't last. And then he saw a structure that had its doors firmly closed and sheets of metal fastened where the windows should be, and, looking closer, he saw that a huge metal clamp sealed the place. He got down and inspected the clamp. It was of a different age than the village. There was no tarnish on it at all. It was old, but not that old. Something or someone at some time had pushed aside the sand in front of the doors. It was grass-grown sand, but it had been disturbed. Johnny frowned. This building was not like the rest. It was in a fair state of preservation. Somebody had put metal sheets on the windows, and the metal was quite different from any in the rest of the town. It showed no signs of corrosion. Somebody had given this building special treatment. He backed up to get a better overall view. It was indeed a different kind of building. Fewer windows, block solid. As an experienced tracker, Johnny studied the time differences here. Long, long after the village had been abandoned, somebody had made access to this place, made a path, even dug a path in and out of the doors and then fastened the doors thoroughly. But even that had been a long time ago. Curious, He scanned the front facade. One of the metal window covers was loose. It was higher than his head, so he stood on his horse and pried at it. It gave a little bit. Encouraged, he shoved the handle of his kill club into the crack, and with a protesting whine, the cover suddenly sprang loose, startling Windsplitter, who moved off. Johnny held on to the ledge, his feet dangling. He pulled himself up. The transparent sheeting under the cover was still in place. He took his kill club and managed to hit it. The crash and tinkle of the stuff as it fell was shockingly loud in this quiet place. Experienced now with the cutting quality of this stuff, Johnny hung on to the ledge with one arm and cleaned up the jagged bits from one side of the frame and dusted off the ledge. He pulled himself through. The place was so dark that it took quite a while to see anything. Light was coming through in thin cracks where other windows remained covered. At length, his eyes adjusted and he dropped cautiously down into the huge room. Now that he was not blocking the window's light, he could see quite well. Dust and sand were only a filmy cover over things. There were tables and tables and tables and chairs and chairs and chairs, all marshaled in orderly rows. But they were not the interesting things. Almost every wall was covered with shelving. The stacks of shelves even protruded out into the room. Somebody had covered them with a sheeting you could see through. Something lay under the sheeting on every shelf. Johnny approached cautiously. He carefully removed the fastenings to the sheeting and looked behind it. Queer, thick rectangles stood on these shelves, rows of them. At first, he thought it was all one piece, and then he found that one could remove a single rectangle. He took one off the shelf. It almost fell to pieces in his hands. Awkwardly, he juggled to hold it together and then succeeded. What a strange object. It was a box that wasn't a box. The covers slid sideways away from each other, enclosing a packet of thin, remarkably thin, slices that had black marks on them, lots of little tiny black marks all in orderly rows. What a strange object. How complicated. He put the first one back on the shelf and took a second, smaller one. It, too, fell open. Johnny found himself staring at a picture. It didn't have depth. At first it seemed to, but his finger told him it was just a flat plane. The object there was a big red circle, much bigger than a strawberry, much smoother. It had a stem, and alongside it there was a black tent with a crossbar in the middle of it. He turned the sheet. There was a picture of a bee. No bee was ever that big, but this was certainly a bee. It, too, looked three-dimensional until his finger told him it wasn't. And a black thing beside it had two bulges on it. Johnny turned another sheet. There was a cat. A small cat, to be sure, but it was definitely a cat. And it had a curved black thing beside it like a new moon. A few pages later, there was a picture of a fox, and beside it was a black pole with two flags coming off it. Suddenly, a quiver went through Johnny. He held his breath. He grabbed the first object he had taken and pried it open again. There was the tent. There was the bee's black mark. Yes, and there was the pole with two flags. He held the two rectangles, his head in a whirl. He stared at them. There was a meaning here. Foxes, bees, cats, tents, bulges, new moons. These things had meanings in them. But about what? Animals? Weather? He could sort all that out later. He crowded the two rectangles into his belt pouch. Anything that was connected to weather and animals had value. Rectangles with meaning in them. The idea made bright lights pop in your skull. He replaced the protective sheet, went back out the window, replaced the metal covering as well as he could, and whistled Windsplitter over, dropping down to the horse's back. Johnny looked around him expansively. Who knew what things of enormous value were in the great village? He felt rich, excited. There was no reason at all for his people to stay cooped up there in the mountains. Here was shelter and to spare. Here was firewood growing in the streets. Here were rooms and rooms and rooms. and come to think of it, he felt better since he had been away from the mountain meadow, better physically. And it hadn't taken a year, actually just a few days. He gathered up the lead rope of his pack horse and they trotted briskly along the wide paths toward the eastern part of the great village. Although his eyes were busily taking it all in, his mind was engrossed in organizing a migration from the mountains down to this place. What he would have to pick up for evidence to convince them. What he was going to say to Staffer. How they could transport their goods. Maybe build a cart? Maybe there were carts right here in the great village. He could round up some horses. These piles of red dust he saw along either side of the wide paths from time to time might once have been carts of a sort. It was hard to figure out what shape they had really had, they were so caved in. The impression of a wheel, sheets of translucent rock. No, they hadn't been horse carts. Or had they? He began to look at such objects more closely. And then he saw the insect. 12. It was very bright daylight now, and there it sat. There could be no mistaking it. Alien. Surely it must be an insect. Only cockroaches looked like that. Or beetles. No, cockroaches. But there were no cockroaches that big. Not 30 feet long and 10 feet high and maybe 12 feet side to side. A horrible brown color. And smooth. Johnny had stopped. The lead horse bunched up behind. The thing was sitting squarely in the middle of the wide path. It seemed to have two eyes in front, slitted. There was nothing like this on the plains or in the mountains, and he had seen nothing like it in the great village center. It looked new, with very little dust on it, and shiny. He felt it was alive. There was something about it. Yes, alive. Not inanimate metal, but a living thing. And he saw what made him think so. There had been a slight rocking motion. Something moved behind the slitted eyes. Johnny, making no sudden movements, turned windsplitter and, pulling the lead horse, began to move away in the direction from which he had approached. He had already noted that these paths were mostly rectangular and that you could go all the way around a group of buildings and come back to the same place. There was open country to the east, not very far. He would go down a side path and then circle back and get out into the plains. Hopefully, he could outrun it, if it moved. There was an ear-splitting roar. Johnny glanced back in terror. The thing rose up 3 feet above the ground. Dust flew from below it. It began to inch forward. It was alive. He put Windsplitter into a gallop straight down the street. He passed one corner path, two. The thing was falling behind. It was now two corners back. He swerved Windsplitter up a side path, yanking the lead horse with him. They reached another corner, and again he turned. Up ahead were two tall buildings. He'd keep going and reach the open country. He'd make it. And then suddenly there was a sheet of flame. Ahead of him, the right-hand building exploded apart. Its top slid slowly down and into the street ahead, blocking it. Spattered with dust, Johnny hauled up short. He could hear the roaring of the thing somewhere beyond the rubble. He listened, holding his breath. The position of the roar was changing. It was shifting to the right. He traced it with his ears. It was going on down the other street. Now it was level with him. Now it was getting behind him. The thing had somehow blocked the street ahead of him and then gone on, planning to come up behind him. He was trapped. Johnny looked at the smoking mound of fresh rubble ahead of him. It rose 20 feet above the pavement, a steep barricade. There was no panic in him now. He slowed the hard pounding of his heart. The thing to do was wait until the monster was right in the street behind him and then go over that barricade. He sidled Windsplitter back to get a good run. The thing was roaring down the side path behind him. Now it was turning. He glanced back. There it was, wisps of smoke coming out of its nostrils. Johnny put the heel to Windsplitter. He yanked on the lead rope. "Ee-yah!" shouted Johnny. The horses sprinted at the barricade, rough and full of loose stones, dangerous. Up they scrambled, rubble slid. Pray the gods, no broken legs. Up they went. They hit the top. One glance back showed the thing rolling up to the very bottom of the barricade. Johnny sent the horses down in a turmoil of tumbling debris. They hit the street before them at a run and kept running. The walls racketed with the thunder of their run. Johnny swerved through a checkerboard of paths, edging to the open country. He could not hear the roaring thing now over the powerful thud of the running hoofs. Further and further, the buildings were thinning. He saw open country between two structures to his right and skidded down off the embankment and raced for freedom. As soon as he had free running space everywhere but toward the town, he slowed. Windsplitter and the lead horse were blowing and puffing. He walked them until they caught their breath, casting his eyes restlessly up and down the edges of the town behind them. Then he caught the roaring again. He strained his eyes, watching. There it was. It slid out from among the buildings and started straight toward him. He put the horses up to a trot. The thing was closing the distance. He put the horses up to a run. The thing not only closed the distance but started to pass him. Johnny swerved at right angles. The thing banked into a turn and flashed by him, went well ahead, turned, and blocked his way. Johnny pulled up. There it was, ugly, roaring, gleaming. He turned around and began to run away from it. It let out a blasting roar, scorched by him, and again stopped, blocking his way. Johnny's face tightened into determination. He took his biggest kill club from his belt. He put the thong solidly on his wrist. He cast off the lead horse. Walking Windsplitter, he went up ahead of the thing. It didn't move. He went about 100 feet in front of the thing. It didn't move. He carefully spotted the position of a slitted eye. He began to whirl the kill club. It swooshed in the air. He put a heel to Windsplitter and they raced straight at the thing. The kill club, carried with the full speed of the running horse, whooshed down straight at the slitted eye. The crash of impact was deafening. Johnny slowed beyond the thing. It had not moved. He trotted Windsplitter back to the original position, 100 feet in front of the thing. He turned and made ready for a second run. The lead horse came up behind him to its habitual place. Johnny glanced at it and then back at the thing. He calculated the distance and the run to strike at the other slitted eye. He touched a heel. Windsplitter plunged forward. And then a great gout of yellow bloomed out from between the eyes. Johnny was struck a blow like all the winds of High Peak rolled into one. Windsplitter caught the full force of it. Up into the air went horse and rider. Down they came with a shuddering crash against the earth. 13. Turl didn't know what he was looking at. He had bunked down in the car in the outskirts. He had the old Chinko map of the ancient city, but he had no curiosity about it. With a few shots of Kerbango, he had eased himself off into sleep, intending to be gone with the dawn, through the city and into the mountains. Senseless, even risky to go on in the dark. The car, however, had grown hot with the morning sun before he awoke. And now he stared out at an odd thing in the street before him. Maybe it had been the footfalls that had awakened him. He didn't know what it was. He had seen horses. They were always falling down mine shafts. But he had never before seen a horse with two heads. That's right, two heads. One in front and one in the middle. And a second animal of similar sort behind. Only this one only had a second body in the middle, as if the second head was bent down out of sight. He batted his eye bones. He shifted over into the driver's seat and stared more intently through the armored windshield. The two beasts had now turned around and were walking the other way, so Turl started up and began to follow. It became apparent to him at once that the beasts knew he was after them. He took a hasty look at his ancient street map, thinking he could flash around a couple of blocks and head them off. But instead, it was the beasts who turned. Turl saw they would dead-end and knew they would circle a block. It was elementary indeed to handle that. He glanced again at his map and spotted the right buildings to make a barricade. The firepower of the old Mark II was not very heavy, but it was surely enough for that. He adjusted the force lever with a fumbling and inexperienced paw and steered the tank into position. He hit the fire button. The resulting explosion was extremely satisfactory. A whole building tipped over to make a barricade. He jockeyed his throttle and wheeled around and went down the street, turned, and sure enough, there they were. He had his quarry trapped. Then he sat with slack jawbones to see the beasts go straight up over the smoking rubble and vanish from view. Turl sat there for a minute or two. Was this any part of what he was trying to accomplish? He was puzzled by the beasts, but they didn't have anything to do with the business he was in. Oh well, he had lots of time, and hunting was hunting after all. He pushed a button and fired off an antenna capsule set to hover 300 feet up, and then turned on his picture screen. Sure enough, there were the beasts tearing along, zigzagging around blocks. He watched their progress while he ate some breakfast. That done, he took a small shot of Kerbango, engaged the drivetrain, and following the picture was soon out in open country with his quarry in plain sight. He raced around in front and blocked them. They turned. He did it again. What were they? The second beast still had his head down, but the one in the lead definitely had two heads. Turl decided he had better not talk about this in the recreation room. They'd roast him. He watched with curiosity when the beast in the front stopped, took a stick out of his belt, and began a run at him. His curiosity turned to amazement. The thing was going to attack him. Incredible. The crash of the club against the windshield was deafening. His ear bones rang with the assault. And that wasn't all. There was an immediate atmosphere sizzle. A wave of dizziness hit Turl. Bright lights popped in his skull. Air. Air was getting into the cab. This old Mark II had seen better days. The supposedly armored windscreen had come loose in its mounts. Turl gaped at it in disbelief. The side gasket had given way. He panicked. Then his eye caught the sign about face masks, and he hastily snatched the mask and flask of breathe gas off the gunner's seat and snapped it over his face, opening the valve. He inhaled deeply, and the dizziness lessened. He took 3 deep breaths to clean the damned air out of his lungs. Turl stared anew at the strange beast. It was lining up for another run. His paws fumbled with the firepower. He wanted no recoil of the blast blowing back through the opened windscreen, and he pulled the force lever low to stun. He hoped it was enough. The beast started to run. Turl hit the fire button. It was enough, all right. The ions sizzled and glared. The beasts were slammed back, lifted clean off the ground. They fell. Turl watched intently to make sure they kept on lying where they had fallen. Good. They did. He let out a shuddering sigh into his mask, winding down. And then he sat up straight in new amazement. He had thought, when they were hit, that he was dealing with 2 four-legged beasts, but lying on the ground, they had come apart. Turl swung a side door wide and crawled out. He checked his belt gun and then rumbled over to the game he had hit. 3 beasts, maybe 4. The 2 four-legged beasts were 2. On the one behind, a bundle of something had fallen apart. That maybe made 3. The nearer one definitely was 2 different beasts. What a confusion. He shook his head, trying to clear it. The effects of air were not wearing off fast enough. Little bright sparks were still popping in front of his eyes. He lumbered over to the more distant one, pushing the tall grass away. It was a horse. He had seen plenty of horses. The plains were full of them. But this horse had had a bundle tied on its back. Simple as that. The bundle had come loose. He kicked it. It wasn't anything alive, just some skins, some animal hides, and nonsense bits of other things. He walked back toward the tank through the high grass. The other thing was also a horse. And over to the right, where it had fallen clear, Turl pushed back the grass. Well, luck of the Gold Nebula, it was a man. The cyclo turned the man over. What a small, puny body. Hair on the face and head, but nowhere else. Two arms, two legs. White-brown skin. Turl was unwilling to admit that Char's description fitted. In fact, he resented the fact that it did come close and promptly rejected it. The chest was moving, only slightly, true, but it was still alive. Turl felt fortunate indeed. His excursion was successful without his even going up into the mountains. He picked the man up with one paw and went back to the tank, throwing the man into the gunner's seat, which engulfed it. Then he set to work repairing the windscreen gasket with some perma-stick. The whole side of the glass had been dislodged, and although the glass itself was not even scratched, that had been quite a blow. He looked down at the small body swallowed in the seat. A fluke. It was the age of this tank, the brittleness of its gaskets. Sure was a ratty car. He'd find something wrong and put it in Zitz's records. Misplaced parts or something. He went over the other gaskets, the doors, and the other screen. They seemed all right, if brittle. Well, he wasn't going underwater, and there would surely be no more attacks from things like that. Turl stood up on the driver's seat and looked all around the horizon. All clear. No more of these beasts. He banged down the top and settled himself. His paw hit the compression change, and the hiss of air exhausting from the cab and the gurgle of breathe gas entering was welcome. His face mask was sweaty in the growing heat of the day, and he hated the thing. Oh, for a proper atmosphere planet, a planet with right gravity, with purple trees. The man-thing went into a sudden convulsion. Turl drew back, alarmed. It was turning blue and jerking about. The last thing he wanted was a raving mad animal inside the cab. Hastily, he adjusted his face mask, reversed the compression, and kicked open the side door. With one bat of his paw, he knocked the thing back out onto the grass. Turl sat there watching it. He was afraid his plans were going up in a puff. The thing must have been more heavily affected by the stun blast than he knew. Crap, they were weak. He opened the cab top and looked over at one of the horses. He could see its sides moving. It was breathing and wasn't in any convulsion. It was even recovering. Well, a horse was a horse, and a man might be... He suddenly got it. The man-thing couldn't breathe gas. The bluish color was fading. The convulsions had stopped. The chest was panting as the thing gulped in air. That gave Turl a problem. Blast if he was going to ride back to the mine site in a face mask. He got out of the car and went to the farther horse. It was recovering, too. The sacks were lying near it. Turl rummaged through one and came up with some thongs. He went back and picked up the man-thing and slammed it up on top of the car. He arranged it so its arms stuck out to each side. Tying piece after piece of thong together, he made a long rope. He tied one end to one wrist of the thing, passed the rope under the car, grunting a bit as he lifted it up to do so, and tied the other wrist. He yanked it good and tight. Then he pushed at the man-thing experimentally to see whether it would fall off. Very good. He threw the sacks onto the gunner's seat and got in, closed up, and restarted the atmosphere change. The nearest horse was lifting its head, struggling to get up. Aside from surface blood boils caused by the stun gun, it seemed to be all right, which meant that the man-thing would probably recover. Turl stretched his jawbones in a grin. Well, it was coming out all right after all. He started up the car, turned it, and headed back toward the mine site. Chapter 2 1 Turl was all efficiency, great plans bubbling in his cavernous skull. The old Chinkos had had a sort of zoo outside the compound, and despite the years that had intervened since the Chinkos were terminated here, the cages were still there. There was one in particular that was just right. It had a dirt floor and a cement pool, and netting of heavy mesh strung all around it. They had had some bears there that they said they were studying, and although the bears had died after a while, they had never escaped. Turl dumped the new beast into the cage. The thing was still only semi-conscious, getting over the shock of breathe gas, most likely. Turl looked at it lying there and then looked around. This had to be just right, all precautions taken. The cage door had a lock on it. It was open to the sky and there was no netting over the top. What bear could climb a 30-foot set of bars? But there was a possibility that this new beast might tamper with the cage door. It wasn't probable, but the door didn't have a good lock on it. Turl had dumped the bags in the cage, having no place else to put them, and the long thong rope he had used was lying on the bags. He decided it would be wise to tie the beast up. He passed the thong around the neck of the thing and tied it there with a simple rigger knot and tied the other end to a bar. He stood back and checked things again. It was fine. He went out and closed the cage door. He'd have to put a better lock on it, but it would do just now. Satisfied with himself, Turl ran the car into the garage and went to his office. There was not much to do. A few dispatches, just forms, no emergencies. Turl finished up and sat back. What a dull place. Ah, well, he had started wheels rolling to get off it, to get back home. He decided he had better go out and see how the man-thing was getting along. He picked up his breathe mask, put a new cartridge into it, and went out through the offices. There were a lot of empty desks these days. There were only 3 secretarial-type cyclos there, and they didn't pay much attention to him. Outside the compound, he reached the gate of the cage. He stopped, his eye bones rattling. The thing was clear over to the gate. He went in with a growl, picked the thing up, and put it into its original place. It had untied the knot. Turl looked at it. Plainly, it was terrified of him. And why not? It only came up to his belt buckle and was about a tenth of his weight. Turl put the thong back around its neck. Being a mining company worker, accustomed to rigs and slings, Turl knew his knots. So this time he tied a double rigger knot. That would hold it. Cheerful once more, Turl went to the garage and got a water hose and began to wash down the Mark II. As he worked, he turned over various plans and approaches in his head. They all depended on that man-thing out there. On a sudden hunch, he went back outside to look into the cage. The thing was standing inside the door. Turl crossly barged in, carried it back to its original position, and stared at the rope. It had untied a double rigger knot. With fast working paws, Turl fixed that. He put the rope around its neck and tied it with a bucket hoist knot. The thing looked at him. It was making some funny noises as if it could talk. Turl walked out, fastened the door, and got out of sight. He wasn't a security chief for nothing. From a vantage point behind a building, he levered his face mask glass to telephoto and observed. The thing, in no time at all, untied the complex bucket hoist knot. Turl rumbled back before it could get to the door. He went in, plucked the thing up, and put it back on the far side of the cage. He wound the rope around and around its neck, and then tied it with a double bucket knot so complex that only a veteran rigger could loosen it. Once more, he went off to an unseen distance. Again believing itself unobserved, what was the thing doing now? It reached into a pouch it was wearing, took out something bright, and cut the rope. Turl rumbled off to the garage and rummaged about through centuries of cast-offs and debris until he found a piece of flexi-rope, a welding torch, a welding power cartridge, and a short strip of metal. When he got back, the thing was over by the door again, trying to climb the 30-foot bars. Turl did a very thorough job. He made a collar out of the metal and welded it hotly around the neck. He welded the flexi rope to the collar and welded the other end into a ring, hooking the ring over a bar 30 feet above the dirt floor of the cage. He stood back. The thing was grimacing and trying to hold the collar away from its neck, for it was still hot. That'll hold it, Turl told himself. But he hadn't finished. He wasn't a security chief for nothing. He went back to his office storeroom and broke out 2 button cameras, checked them, and switched them to the wavelength of his office viewer. Then he went back to the cage and put one button camera way up in the bars, pointing down, and put the other one out at a distance where it could view the exterior. The thing was pointing at its mouth and making sounds. Who knew what that meant? Only now did Turl feel relaxed. That night, he sat smugly in the employee recreation room, responding to no questions, quietly drinking his Kerbango in a very self-satisfied way. 2. Johnny Goodboy Tyler stared in despair at his packs across the yard. The sun was hot. The collar on his burned neck hurt. His throat was parched with thirst, and he felt hungry. In those packs just inside the cage door, there was a pig bladder of water. There was some cooked pork if it hadn't spoiled, and there were hides he could rig for shade. At first he had just been trying to get out. The very idea of being caged made him feel ill, sicker even than the lack of water and food. It was all so unknown. The last he really remembered was starting to charge the insect and being blown into the air. Then this. No, wait. There was something after he was first stunned. He had started to come to, lying on something soft and smooth. He had seemed to be inside the insect. He had seen a huge something next to him. And then there was a sensation like breathing fire straight into his lungs that pulled every nerve short and threw him into a convulsion. There was another glimpse of an occurrence. He had flickeringly regained consciousness for a few moments. He seemed to be tied on top of the insect speeding across the plain. And then the back of his head bumped, and the next he knew he was in here, in this cage. He put it together. He had hurt the insect, but not fatally. It had eaten him, but then spit him up. It had carried him on its back to its lair. But the real shock was the monster. It was true, he knew now, that he had always been too smart. He had doubted his elders. He had doubted the great village, and there it had been. He had doubted the monsters, and here one was. When he had come to and found himself looking up at that thing, his head had reeled. He felt himself literally bending the bars behind him to get away. A monster. 8 or 9 feet tall, maybe more. About 3.5 feet wide. 2 arms, 2 legs. A shiny substance for a face, and a long tube from the chin down to the chest. Glowing amber eyes behind the shiny front plate. The ground shook as it approached. 1,000 pounds? Maybe more. Huge booted feet dented the earth, and it had furry paws and long talons. He had been certain it was going to eat him right then, but it hadn't. It had tied him up like a dog. There was something strange about this monster's perceptions. Every time he had tried to get untied and out of the cage, the monster had shown up again, as though it could see when it wasn't around to see. Possibly those little spheres had had something to do with it. The monster held them in its paws like small detachable eyes. One was up there now, glittering, way up in the corner of the cage, like a little eye. The other one was out there stuck onto a nearby building side. But the monster had caught him trying to get out before it planted those eyes. What was this place? There was a constant rumble from somewhere. A muted roar similar to the one the insect had made. The thought of more of those insects chilled him. There was a big stone basin in the middle of the cage, a few feet deep, with steps up one side. Lots of sand was in the bottom of it. A grave? A place to roast meat? No, there were no charred sticks or ashes in it. So there were monsters. When he stood in front of it, his face was just above the level of its belt buckle. Belt buckle? Yes, a shiny thing that held a belt together. It suddenly dawned on Johnny that the monster was wearing a covering that wasn't its own skin, a slippery, shiny purple substance. It wasn't its own hide. Like clothes you'd cut out of a hide, pants, a coat, a collar. It wore clothes. Ornaments on the collar, and a device of some sort on the belt buckle. That device was stamped on his mind's eye right now. It was a picture of ground on which stood small square blocks. Vertical shafts were going up from the square blocks. Out of the shafts seemed to be coming clouds of smoke, and smoking curls lay all over the top of the picture. The idea of clouds of smoke stirred some memory in him, but he was too hungry and too thirsty and too hot to wrestle with it. The ground under him began to shake in measured tread. He knew what this was. The monster came to the door. It was carrying something. It came in and loomed over him. It threw down into the dirt some soft, gooey sticks of something. Then it just stood there. Johnny looked at the sticks. They weren't like anything he had ever seen. The monster made motions, pointing from the sticks to his face. That failing, the monster took up a stick and squashed it against Johnny's mouth, saying something in a rumbling, roaring voice. A command. Johnny got it. This was supposed to be food. He worked a bit of it around in his mouth, and then swallowed it. Abruptly and immediately, he was violently ill. He felt like his whole stomach was going to rush back out of his mouth. Before he could control them, his limbs went into the beginning of a convulsion. He spat. Too thirsty to have much saliva, he tried to get rid of the stuff, all of it, every bit of it, every tiny piece of the acid taste of it. The monster just backed up and stood there staring at him. "Water," pleaded Johnny, getting control of his shaking limbs and voice. "Please, water." Anything to wash this horrible stuff out. He pointed to his mouth. "Water." The monster just went on standing there. The eyes back of the faceplate were slitted, glowing with an eerie fire. Johnny composed himself stoically. It was wrong to look weak and beg. There was such a thing as pride. He drew his face into stillness. The monster leaned over and checked the collar and the flexi rope, turned around and went back out, closed the gate with a firm clang, wired it shut, and left. The evening shadows were growing long. Johnny looked at his packs by the gate. They might as well be on the top of High Peak. A cloak of misery settled over him. He had to assume Windsplitter was gravely injured or dead, and he had to assume that in a few days, he himself probably would die of thirst or hunger. Twilight came, and then, with a shock, he realized Chrissy's promise to find him would wind up in her certain death. He caved in. The little bright eye up in the corner of the cage stared down unwinking. 3. The following day, Turl probed around the disused quarters of the old Chinkos. It was unpleasant work. The quarters were outside the pressurized cyclo domes of the mine site, and he had to wear a breathe mask. The Chinkos were air breathers, and while quarters had been sealed off, a few hundred years of neglect and weather leaks had left their marks. There were rows and rows of bookcases, lines and lines of filing cabinets full of notes, old scarred desks, rickety and frail to begin with, collapsing into themselves, piles of junk and lockers, and everything filmed over with white dust. Good thing he didn't have to breathe it. What funny beings the Chinkos had been. They were the Intergalactic Mining Company's answer to some protests by more warlike and able worlds that mining was wrecking planetary ecologies. And the company being plush and profitable at that time, some knothead of a director in Intergalactic's main office had created the Culture and Ethnology Department, or C&E. Maybe it was originally named the Ecological Department, but Chinkos could paint, and some intergalactic directors, Wear the Claw's wife, had begun to make a private fortune selling Chinko work on other planets and got the name changed. There was very little that didn't show up in the secret files of the Security Department. It was the strike the Chinkos had invented, not the corruption that caused the final wipeout. Corruption at director level was very paws off for security. A strike was not. But the Chinkos here had been gone long before that, and this place looked it. What, after all, was worth culturing on this planet? There weren't enough indigenous populations left to bother with. And who had cared anyway? But like any bureaucracy, the Chinkos had been busy. Look at those hundreds of yards of cabinets and books. Turl was looking for a manual on the feeding habits of man. Surely these busy Chinkos had studied that. He pawed and pawed. He opened and flipped hundreds of indexes. He got down and poked into lockers. And while he got a very good idea of what there was in these rambling offices and lockers, he couldn't find one single thing about what man ate. He found what bears ate. He found what mountain goats ate. He even found a treatise, scholarly composed, printed, and reeking with wasted expense, on what some beast known as a whale ate, a treatise that ended up laughably enough with the fact that the beast was totally extinct. Turl stood in the middle of the place, disgusted. No wonder the company had phased out C&D on Earth. Imagine roaring around, burning up fuel, keeping a whole book manufacturing plant steaming like a digger shovel, wearing out eyesight. It wasn't all in vain, though. He had learned from the aged and yellowed map he now gripped in his hand that there were a few other groups of men left on this planet. At least, there had been a few hundred years ago. Some were in a place the Chinkos called Alps. Several dozen, in fact. There had been about 15 up in the ice belt the Chinkos called North Pole and Canada. There had been an unestimated number at a place called Scotland, and there had been some in Scandinavia, and also in a place called Colorado. This was the first time he had seen the Chinko name for this central mine site area, Colorado. He looked at the map with some amusement. Rocky Mountains, Pike's Peak. Funny Chinko names. The Chinkos always did their work in painfully severe cyclo, faithful to their ore. But they had had funny imaginations. This was getting him no place, however, although it was good to know, for the sake of his planning, that there had been a few more men around. He would have to rely on what he should have relied on in the first place. Security. The techniques of security. He would put them to work. He walked out and closed the door behind him and stared around at this non-cyclo alien world. The old Chinko offices, barracks, and zoo were up on the high hill back of the mine site. Close by, but higher, the arrogant bastards. One could see all around from this place. One could see the ore transshipment platform as well as the freighter assembly field. The place didn't look very busy down there. Intergalactic would be sending some sizzlers down the line unless quotas were met. He hoped he wouldn't have too many investigations ordered by the home office. Blue sky, yellow sun, green trees, and the wind that tugged at him full of air. How he hated this place. The thought of staying made him grit his fangs. Well, what do you expect in an alien world? He'd finished that investigation ordered about a lost tractor, and then put his tried-and-true security technology to work on that man-thing. That was the only way out of this hellhole. 4. Johnny watched the monster. Thirsty, hungry, and with no hope, he felt adrift in a sea of unknowns. The thing had come into the cage, its footsteps shaking the earth, and had stood there for some time just looking at him, small glints of light in its amber eyes. Then it had begun to putter around. Right now it was testing the bars, shaking them, apparently verifying that they were firm. Satisfied, it rumbled all around the perimeter, inspecting the dirt. It stood for a while, looking at the sticks it had tried to make Johnny eat. Johnny had pushed them as far away as possible, since they had a bad, pungent smell. The monster counted them. Aha! It could count. It spent some time examining the collar and rope, and then it did a very strange thing. It unhooked the rope's far end from the bar top. Johnny held his breath. Maybe he could get to his packs. But the monster now hooked the rope on a nearby bar. He dropped a loop over the bar indifferently and then moved off to the door. It spent some time at the door, rewinding the wires that kept it closed, and did not seem to notice that when it turned its back on the door, one of the wires sprang free. The monster rumbled off toward the compound and disappeared. Lightheaded with thirst and hunger, Johnny felt he was having delusions. He was afraid to hope, but there it was. The rope could be removed, and the gate fastening might be loose enough to open. He made very sure the monster was really gone. Then he acted. With a flip of the rope, he got the far end off the bar. Hastily, he wrapped the length around his body to get it out of his way and tucked the end into his belt. He dove for his packs. With shaking hands, he ripped them open. Some of his hope died. The water bladder had burst, probably from the earlier impact, and there was only dampness there. The pork, wrapped in hide that retained the sun's heat, was very spoiled, and he knew better than to eat it. He looked at the door. He would try. Grabbing a kill club and rope from the pack and checking his belt pouch for flints, Johnny crept to the door. No sign of the monster. The wires of the fastening were awfully big, but age had weakened them. Even so, they tore and bruised his hands as he feverishly sought to open them. Then they were open. He pushed against the door. In seconds, he was sprinting through the shrubs and gullies to the northwest, keeping low, taking advantage of every bit of cover so as to remain hidden from the compound. He nevertheless went fast. He had to find water. His tongue was swollen, his lips cracked. He had to find food. He felt the light-headed unreality that came with the beginnings of starvation. Then he had to get back to the mountains. He had to stop Chrissy. Johnny went a mile. He examined his back trail. Nothing. He listened. No sound of the insect, no feel of monster feet shaking the earth. He ran 2 miles. He stopped and listened again. Still nothing. Hope flared within him. Ahead he could see greenery, a patch jutting out of a gully, a sign of water. His breath hoarse and rattling in his chest, he made the edge of the gully. No scene could be more heartwarming. A speck of blue and white, the cheerful burble of a small brook running through the trees. Johnny lunged forward and a moment later plunged his head into the incalculably precious water. He knew better than to drink too much. He just kept rinsing his mouth. For minutes he plunged his head and chest in and out of the stream, letting the water soak in. Gone was the taste of that terrible gooey stick. The freshness and cleanness of the brook were almost as joyful as its wetness. He drank a few cautious swallows, and then sank back, catching his breath. The day looked brighter. The back trail was still quiet. The monster might not discover he was gone for hours. Hope surged again. Far off to the northwest, just a little bit above the curve of the plain, were the mountains. Home. Johnny looked around him. There was an old rickety shack on the other side of the stream bed, the roof sunk down to its foundation. Food was his concern now. He took more swallows of water and stood up. He hefted his kill club and walked through the stream toward the ancient shack. While running, he had seen no game. Perhaps it was cleared out in the vicinity of the compound. But he didn't need big game. A rabbit would do. He had better take care of this fast and keep going. Something moved in the shack. He crept forward, silent. In a scurry, several big rats raced out of the shack. Johnny had started his throw and then stopped. Only in the dreariest of a starving winter would one eat rats. But he had no time and he saw no rabbits. He picked up a rock and threw it against the shack. 2 more rats streamed out, and he threw his kill club straight and true. A moment later, he was holding a dead rat in his hand, a big one. Did he dare light a fire? No, no time for that. Raw rat? Ugh. He took a piece of the sharp, clear stuff from his pouch and stepped back to the stream. He cleaned and washed the rat. Hunger or no hunger, it took some doing to bite into the raw rat meat. Almost gagging, he chewed and swallowed. Well, it was food. He ate very slowly so that he wouldn't get any sicker than he felt at eating raw rat. Then he drank some more water. He wrapped a last piece of the rat in a scrap of hide and put it in his pouch. He kicked some sand over the debris he had left. He stood up straight and looked at the distant mountains. He took a deep breath, bracing himself to start again on his run. There was a low whistle in the air and something fell over him. He rolled. It was a net. He couldn't get free. The more he tried to get out of it, the more tangled up he became. He stared wildly around. Through the opening, he saw the truth. The monster, without haste, was moving forward out of the trees, taking in the slack of the rope to which the net was attached. The thing exhibited no emotion. It moved as though it had all the time in the world. It wrapped Johnny up in the net and tucked the whole bundle under its arm, and then began to rumble along back toward the compound. 5. Turl, fiddling with forms at his desk, felt very cheerful. Things were working out fine, just fine. Security techniques were always best, always. He now knew exactly what he had wanted to know. The thing drank water and drank it by plunging its head and shoulders into a stream or pond. And more importantly, it ate raw rat. This made things very easy. If there was any animal available near the compound, it was rat. He guessed he could teach the old chinkos a thing or two. It was elementary to let the man-thing loose and elementary to keep him under surveillance with a flying scope. It was, of course, a little trying to be out in the open wearing a breathe mask and yet make speed over the ground. That man-thing didn't run very fast compared to a cyclo, but it had been a bit of an exertion. It was hard to exert oneself while wearing a breathe mask. But he hadn't lost his skill in casting nets, old-fashioned though it might be. He hadn't wanted to use a stun gun again. The thing seemed frail and went into convulsions. Well, he was learning. He began to wonder how many raw rats a day the thing had to consume, but he could find that out easily. He looked with boredom at the report before him. The lost tractor had been found along with its cyclo driver at the bottom of a 2-mile-deep mine shaft. They ate up a lot of personnel these days. There'd be a yowl from the main office about replacement costs. Then he cheered up. This fitted very well into his plans. He checked around to make sure he had no more work to do and put his desk in order for the end of the day. Turl went over to a cabinet and took out the smallest blast gun he could find. He put a charge cartridge in it and set it to minimum power. He took some rags and cleaned up his face mask and put a new cartridge in it. Then he went outside. Not 100 yards north of the compound, he saw his first rat. With the accuracy that had won him an honored place on his school shoot team, even though the thing was in streaking motion, he blew its head off. 50 feet farther, another rat leaped out of a culvert, and he decapitated it in midair. He paced off the distance. 42 cyclo paces. No, he hadn't lost his touch. Silly things to be hunting, but it still took a master's touch. 2. That would be good enough to start with. Turl looked around at the hateful day. Yellow, blue, and green. Well, he'd get quit of this. Feeling very cheerful, he rumbled up the hill to the old zoo. His mouth bones stretched in a grin. There was the man-thing crouched down at the far side of the cage, glaring at him. Glaring at him? Yes, it was true. It was the first time Turl had noticed it had emotions. And what else had it been doing? It had gotten to the packs. He remembered the thing clutching at them when he had returned it to the cage yesterday, and it was now sitting on them. It had been doing something else. It had been looking down at a couple of books. Books? Now where the crap nebula had it gotten books? Didn't seem possible it could have gotten into the old chinko quarters. The collar, the rope, were all secure. He'd investigate that in due course. The thing was still here, which was what was important. Turl advanced, smiling behind his mask. He held up the 2 dead rats and then tossed them to the man thing. It didn't jump hungrily at them. It seemed to withdraw. Well, gratitude wasn't something you found in animals. No matter. Turl wasn't after gratitude from this thing. Tyrrell went over to the old cement bear pool. It didn't seem to be cracked. He traced the piping. The piping seemed to be all right. He went outside the cage and fumbled around in the undergrowth, looking for the